Today we discuss self-help books, which have been around for perhaps a lot longer than we realize. They've grown in popularity over the last half century to cultural prominence, and joining us with their own suggestions in that genre is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
And Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Melanie.
Good morning, Mindy.
And you're looking much better. We were going to do this last week. You were a little under the weather, so glad to see that you're feeling better.
I was very under the weather.
Yes. So self-help books, been around for a while. Jill, you found one from 1859.
That is correct. This is apparently the first one that was actually called self-help, although they were certainly around before this. And this one is Self-Help with Illustrations of Character, Conduct, and Perseverance by a guy named, I kid you not, Samuel Smiles. It seems like a great name for this guy. And it originally published in 1859, sold 20,000 copies in the first year, 55,000 by 1864, and 150,000 by 1889. So this is not a new phenomena. Yeah. And there was a big article actually in New York Magazine about this phenomena of self-help, which gets bigger and bigger. And one of the things they pointed out was that 20 years ago, when Chicken Soup for the Soul was published, which is a big hit, everyone knew where to find self-help books and sort of what it was. But whatever you thought of self-help, Godsend, Guilty Pleasure, Snake Oil, the genre was safely contained on one eclectic bookstore shelf. Today, every section of the store overflows with instructions, and that goes to novels that are sort of self-help novels, and across the board, whether it be fiction or nonfiction.
Right. You can turn every action that humans take, including things like gardening and cooking and stuff, into a self-help book. They can take that angle, and so it opens the door to just about everything to come through. And I think also part of where this goes is to people, once they realized back in the old days that they were able to secure their food and shelter and things like that, then they had time and leisure to turn and say, well, how can I make myself better? Because for a lot of people, that was the only way to do it. They weren't going to have access to higher education or anything like that. So self-help, self-improvement, which is, I think, a lot of times it was called, was a huge deal for people who wanted to get ahead.
Yeah, and we were saying, this goes back, really, if you think about it, ancient Egyptian code of conduct. So really, this goes back really, really early.
Yeah.
Just didn't call it self-help back then. All right, so I guess how are we defining self-help?
Good question.
That's a very good question. Well, one of the things that I have noticed, that it has been around so long that now there is a book called 50 Self-Help Classics. And the way they describe this is 50 inspirational books to transform your life. And I think self-help is about transforming your life. As the subtitle continues, from timeless sages to contemporary gurus. And within this, he covers all kinds of ground. So you've got the obvious, perhaps, the Bible, but he also has the more contemporary Iron John by Robert Bly. He's got Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence, which, by the way, came out in 1936. I didn't realize it had been around that long. And Wayne Dyer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Self-Reliance, came out in 1841. So there's a huge spectrum of what is considered self-help. And I have to say for myself, I have a very special self-help book that I use, which I would have to say not many people would consider self-help. But whenever I'm in trouble with anything, it really doesn't matter what, I'll go back to Rilke and his Letters to a Young Poet, which is this beautiful book. And if you've never picked it up, go do yourself a favor. Go pick up a copy. It is 10 letters that he wrote to this young poet. And I have been reading this somebody gave me a copy probably when I was in high school or college, and have been reading it ever since. And the wonderful thing about it is that it's sort of this simple, good advice. And even though it's advice that he was giving specifically to this young man who wanted to be a poet, and because he wanted to be a poet, one of the things that's really good about this book is that if you're an artist of any kind, it offers a lot of sort of solace about being an artist. So let me just give you one little snippet here of the kind of advice that Rilke is offering up. If you trust in nature, in what is simple in nature, in the small things that hardly anyone sees, and that can so suddenly become huge, immeasurable, If you have this love for what is humble and try very simply, as someone who serves, to win the confidence of what seems poor, then everything will become easier for you, more coherent and somehow more reconciling. Not in your conscious mind, perhaps, which stays behind, astonished, but in your innermost awareness, awakeness, and knowledge. You are so young, so much before all beginning, and I would like to beg you, dear sir, as well as I can, to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart, and to try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language.
When was that written?
Came out, let me see if I've got an original copyright date on this. Some time ago. Let me see. Copyright, actually, this is showing the copyright of the edition, which was 1984, and I don't know what the actual original date of the publication was, but it holds up amazingly
I think so. You said you got it in high school or college.
That's right.
It's been a while.
It has been a while, and as it says on the back of this version of it, and there are different translations of this as well, arguably the most famous and beloved letters of our century, written when the poet was himself still a young man with most of his greatest work before him. Really some time ago.
And perhaps if you're listening, you have a favorite self-help book, as Jill just shared hers with us. Give us a call and share yours. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. So I guess we start with making yourself better. Is that the category?
I was going to say that I tend to think of myself as somewhat intellectual, but I don't think I turned to Rilke. I think I turned to channel flipping and chocolate. But on the other side of that is I try to think, or I would hope that everything I choose to read is self-helpful in some way. It either fills in a gap in my knowledge, or it soothes a rough part of my thinking or my feelings, or it opens a door that wasn't open before and allows me to sort of expand myself into another area where I wasn't aware before, that kind of thing. And when it really comes down to it, I love the transcendentalist, so I'm going to go for Emerson almost every time. For some reason, he and Thoreau, but especially Emerson, just speak to me. So that's where I turn. But these two books here and Making Yourself Better, the first one I held on to for quite a while. The second one, I think, is the kind of thing that we see all the time on shelves. It's called Body by You, the You Are Your Own Gym Guide to Total Women's Fitness. And they have another one called You Are Your Own Gym. So guys, you're not left out of this. And basically what this book says, and this is brand new, the author is a certified military physical training specialist. His name is Mark Lauren, and he had a bestseller in that original book. But basically what this is body weight exercise, which a lot of people practice anyway. As soon as you go for a walk, you're basically using your own body and the and gravity to basically strengthen your own muscles and bones. But he suggests there's a lot of other ways to do this too. Anytime you stretch, do a push-up, do a pull-up, in some ways you're doing the same kind of thing. So that's what this book is about. And he says there's a common misperception out there that body weight exercise options are limited. Push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and not much else. Did I mention that there are 125 different exercises or variations in the book? Other people think it's impossible to work certain muscle groups with body weight exercises. Wrong again. Every single muscle group, and some you probably didn't know existed, those are the ones I find when I work out, can be worked without weights. And I think for a lot of people who are hesitant to go to the gym or don't want to pay for a gym, I think there's a surprising amount of common sense in a book, in this particular book, but in books like it, that you can look around your house and look at door frames, staircases, pieces of furniture, tables, things like that, and turn them into workout equipment that will work just as well as a fancy piece of equipment. And I myself, when I go out and I walk, when I come back, I use my back steps for push-ups. Works just fine. And a friend and I, when we go walking at the rec center, when we finish with that, we do push-ups, we do sit-ups, and we also do planks on raised benches.
That's the best for your core.
Planks are incredible. Yeah. So this kind of book shows you how you can make make that happen. And it's a lot less expensive than a membership, but I think it's also the kind of thing that you might find that you integrate more into your daily life.
Right. What's your second
one? The second one is by the people, Rhodes Scholar, who used to be Elder Hostel. And Rhodes Scholar has a new book out called Master Class, Living Longer, Stronger, and Happier by Peter Spires. And it has a foreword by Brian Williams in it. And this book is also brand new. And the interesting thing about it, it's for people who of a certain age, and I would say somewhere from 50 up, and a Rhodes Scholar is generally for people who are 50 and up. And it suggests that if you think, or if you've been pondering how you're going to fill in the gaps of your life when you retire or lessen your workload or your children leave, I have people saying already, oh, you're about to be an empty nester. And
it never crossed my mind.
Yeah, I know. It never crossed my mind that that was a bad thing.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I saw it as a good thing. But they ask a series of questions in the front of this. This book might be good for you. Are you an empty nester whose children have finally, exclamation point, grown and left home? Do you expect to retire in the next few years? Have you recently retired? And on and on and on. Do you want to get back in touch with who you used to be? And I think that's a really key question for people if they look for self-help. What did you like about yourself as a younger person? And what are those things you'd like to recapture? Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that that's a good way if you're thinking, I need to do something for myself, and you go to the bookstore, you go to the library, and you look at the shelves full of self-help. How do you choose? Well, I think that's not a bad way to start by saying, I loved being athletic, or I loved being lighthearted, or something mm-hmm. like that when I was younger, and I want to recapture that.
Yeah.
And you look for that kind of book.
Yeah. Jill, what have you got?
Well, I have along the lines of that first book that Melanie was talking about, and in terms of exercise, it's that time of year, you know, beginning of February.
I know.
Everyone had made those resolutions January 1st, and they're probably done with them. So it's time to think again about how you can incorporate movement, for example, into what it is you're doing with your life. And I love this book because I love the sort of attitude of the author. It's called The Unapologetic Fat Girl's Guide to Exercise and Other Incendiary Acts by Hannah Blank. And it is really a fun read, I have to say. And most self-help books, this is one of
boring.
The problems I have with them is they are really badly written and they are not fun. This one is fun. And she talks right at the beginning about why she's using this word fat. And she says, I know that a lot of you reading this will cringe the first few times you see it, maybe even the first few dozen times, but you'll get used to it. It'll become just another word that can be used to describe bodies like short or bald or lanky or freckled. That's the point. Fat is, you know, just another word that can be used to describe bodies. Fat bodies are bodies just like any other bodies. They deserve the same respect, the same nurture, the same care, and the same attention as any other. So she does, you know, goes on about why this word is okay. And then she goes on. She's very funny. So she goes on. She has a list of 30 things to love about exercise, none of which have anything to do with your weight, your size, or what you look like. So for example, number 11 is your joints get stronger and less prone to injuries and diseases, including tricky ones like repetitive stress injuries and arthritis. But she also has number 15, outrunning the zombies. So she certainly has a sense of humor. And then she has a list of 101 things you can do with your body. And her approach is really trying to make you move in whatever way you can. So in this list she has starts out, stretch, really stretch hard. When you yawn, that she has. Number 5 is scratch your own back. Number 7, walk on your tiptoes. Play Twister, dog paddle. Number 19, take a long hot bath. So she's any kind of movement, but it goes into, you know, go birding, play air guitar, rock climb, lots of ways you can get your body moving that you might not think of.
That's
on your
a little
own.
More fun than just That's, exercise. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. We should say Patty called in to say that the first letter of Letters to a Young Poet was written in 1903. The collection was published in the early 1920s. Patty, thanks for that information. I thought it was.
I knew it was early. Didn't realize exactly that it was that early.
Yeah.
Another one, having to do with aging is a great book called Aging as a Spiritual Practice, A Contemplative Guide to Growing Older and Wiser by a fellow named Lewis Richman. And Richman is a Buddhist, and I've discovered there is a whole sort of subgenre of Buddhist self-help. It's surprising and interesting to me that that should be become such a part of the self-help genre. And Richman offers an inner roadmap for aging, acknowledging the fear, anger, and sorrow many people experience when they must confront the indignities of their aging bodies and the unknowns associated with mortality, as well as explaining the four key stages of aging. And he talks about that aging is not just change, but irreversible change for better or for worse. And the real question is, what do we do about it? He weaves current scientific findings with the stories of older adults, including his own, to illuminate aspects of aging and includes useful information about the stages of aging. And I think that what he talks about right at the beginning, this is how he starts. He says, this book is a user's guide to aging well. It is not a book about diet or exercise, crossword puzzles, or memory tips. Those books have already been written and offer much that is valuable and useful. This book is different. It is about aging from a spiritual perspective.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
And it's and again, he gives little exercises on how to sort of work into your aging into your consciousness and how to sort of accept that you are aging, and also talks a lot about how people have very, very different attitudes about
what old is
and what aging is.
Is that it for your make yourself better category?
Oh, I think all self-help is all really right. Make yourself better.
Emotional. We're going to emotions now.
All right. Well, there's just a ton of books on the shelf for this. But I think that part of what stops people from making the improvement they want to make is that they don't imagine that they deserve it or are capable of having it or don't have the tools to acquire it or whatever. So the first thing I think that you have to get past is that you probably do have those tools or that ability. And the thing is, you have to unlock something in yourself that allows you to either see it or discover it or whatever. And I liked this book when it came in. It's called Believable Hope, Five Essential Elements to Beat Any Addiction by Michael Cartwright. And the reason I liked it, because I was immediately curious about what believable hope is. And I think that's a key element that he's isolated for most of us, that people are always telling us, well, you should hope for this or hope for that. But if it isn't something that we find believable, and in this case, the opposite of pie in the sky or unlikely, then I think that most of us find it pretty easy to dismiss that particular kind of hope. And so what this book is about is isolating instances where you can find hope that's believable for you. And then once you have ownership of that hope, then you can make changes that you want to make. And I think that's a great way to start with people. I think that if you believe you could make a change and you believe in a way that makes sense to you, then you have an open door to change rather than thinking that you have to acquire something that you've never had before in order to make that change. And he writes about his grandmother, who really, I think, led their family. And he says that no matter what happened, and again, this is one of those great stories of a family that came up during the Depression who didn't know they were poor because they had all the basic elements in place, family, enough work, enough food on the table, that kind of thing, shelter. So they didn't really feel like they were as bad off as other people. But one of the things that this woman, grandmother Cartwright, had was a consistent positivity, just consistent. And I'm reminded of someone in my own life who's about to turn 95 this weekend and has had plenty of adversity in a very long life, but is so consistently positive that we don't think she's ever been shaken in her basic belief that everything is going to be okay. And I think that part of this book is isolating that little kernel of what it is that makes people change their minds about the color of things. Are they black or are they light? And to find a path into a different way of being. And I think this book is very useful in that.
What have you got, Jill?
I've got a very practical kind of guide here, I think, called Throw Out 50 Things.
I need that
Clear
book.
The Clutter, Find Your Life by Gail Blank. And what distinguishes this book is her advice to let go of not only stuff, but also regrets. ideas about your personality type and the need to be liked by everyone. So it starts out with this very sort of practical getting rid of the physical stuff, and chapter by chapter, your bedroom, your bathroom, your kitchen, your living room. She goes through every room in the house. She goes through the office, and then she gradually gets on to attacking the mental mess, as she calls it. And I have to say, she is very firm about what you should throw out. And she says towards the beginning of this book, don't, just like my mother didn't, and not only do I ask them to throw out 50 things, I ask them to make a list of what they're throwing out. Actually, it's not that hard to get into the swing of it. Look, you've had that single earring for years, and you keep hoping the other one will show up.
Funny.
It won't. Throw it away.
She's been looking in my jewelry box. Yeah.
And she goes on with a whole list of things like that sort. And then the one of the chapters that really struck me was the steps for clearing the clutter in your garage. One, open up the garage door. How do you feel when somebody drives by and sees all the stuff in it? Mm-hmm. Who cares what they think anyway, right? But still, the garage seems to be a sort of way station for things we don't really want around but haven't decided to get rid of. Now's the time
like
to get rid of
my
them.
My basement. When you're talking about this, I'm thinking we had a yard sale and my husband's bringing up the lamp. I'm going, no, not that lamp. You know, that's been in the basement for probably a decade.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And back this it goes again, right?
Clearly the book you
As
need.
He's bringing it out, I'm bringing it back in. Yeah.
Well, they do equate clutter with mental health issues.
Uh-oh.
Well, they do. They do.
Well, yes, then we get into hoarding, which is a whole other
show. Not that bad.
Even at just the level of clutter, that if your house is cluttered, your mind has got to be cluttered because you can't see to the surfaces. I mean, that's just a physical mind-body thing. I really do believe that.
I have organized chaos, I think.
Okay, that's different. That better be different. Yeah.
Well, and another book I brought along is this book called Changeology, which is 5 Steps to Realizing Your Goals and Resolutions by John C. Norcross. And what I love about this is that it is very practical. This is, again, steps to change things. 10 proven ways. He has a whole chapter just on the fact that we know, again, it being the beginning of February, that people slip up, that people try to do things and then they slip up. And he has 10 proven ways to resist the urge of slipping up. And number one is take a breather. Again, sort of that Buddhist thing again, take a few deep breaths, inhaling and exhaling slowly. Slow down your physical cravings and your runaway thinking. Relaxation will get you through a surprising number of potential slips. But I like the fact that he is very upfront about you can change things, but you are going to not always succeed. And here are some real tips that can help get you through that. And very easy to read, very straightforward, sort of the scientific approach to change.
Jenny in the studio recommends The Power to Heal Myself by Woods Hole's own Betty Jean Wall. Betty was trained as a biologist, worked in science. She later studied Jinsen Jitsu, an ancient healing art. Jenny says the book has great simple techniques to deal with a range of issues, and it works, in all caps she has there. So, and for those who are trying to jot down all these titles, we will have a link on our website to the book list, so no worries there. Moving on to family?
I think so. There's a lot there's a lot to look at. And I think families are sometimes underlooked at, you know, in some of these books. And also, but they are also the source of much control and chaos and care in our lives. So I think when we look at the family and we help families make changes or become as much as they can be as a family unit, I think we help people for the rest of their lives. And this first book that got my attention is called Family Inc., Office-Inspired Solutions to Reduce the Chaos in Your Home and Save Your Sanity by Caitlin and Andrew Friedman. And both of these folks were professionals who realized that the better they did at their jobs, the more their house went to hell in a handbasket. And as they had children, they didn't have any new ways of organizing and putting things together so that everyone had a place in this. And they do talk about a plan for weekdays, but also a plan for weekends. So your weekends don't get away from you. I mean, we all know that the lunches have to be made and the papers packed and things like that on weekdays. But if you had a plan for the weekend, what would be in it? And would you achieve it without writing it down and actually going after it? Or would you grant yourself, and there's nothing wrong with this, the right to lay on the couch most of the day and watch bad movies or eat last night's
sometimes
pizza
leftover?
Sometimes you
need a day like
that's
that.
Not a bad thing at all. But if you really felt like you wanted to do other things, like work on a family project or do recreation, which is a little bit different to have a day of recreation, then that kind of thing they say you have to plan for. And they also talk about conflict resolution, that if you plan for conflict resolution, you're going to have a happier family too.
Right. Let's talk to Chris, who's giving us a call from Tisbury. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I'd like to suggest a book called A Course in Miracles.
A Course in Miracles. I've heard
Marianne
of that.
Marianne Williams is that?
She's sort of a student of the Course. Quite a few authors have read the Course and then generated their own versions of the teachings. Mm-hmm. So Marianne Williams is one of the big well-known authors who refers to Course in Miracles.
Mm-hmm. Give us sort of a quick gist, Chris, what it's about.
Well, it's a very difficult read, at least it was for me, because it's written in with a lot of Christian terminology, and I avoid too much organized religion. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, what it basically says is that pretty much everything that our society in general teaches is not particularly valuable to us, so we need to reprogram ourselves.
Great. Chris, thanks for the suggestion. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling in. Jill, what have you got?
I just want you to know that How Proust Can Change Your Life is really the title of a book by Alain de Botton. It is, in fact, in the 50 self-help classics. And if you do not want to read all of Proust, which I have been doing for 3 years and have finished, this is a great way to both get introduced to Proust and the ideas of Proust, but also he has a lot to say. And the in-a-nutshell version of this is appreciate the rich experience of life despite circumstances. Low expectations make for pleasant surprises.
All right. Melanie, you got about a minute or so left.
Okay, I'm going to switch, and I'm going to point to a book that's for kids and young adults. It's called Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt by David Kessler. And David Kessler is the former director of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And he had written a book about the end of overeating. That's what it was called. But he decided that it missed the one demographic group who really needed this information. They needed it in a way that was aimed at them and written for them. And so he's written Your Food is Fooling You. And on the cover, there's a big tomato, which you're less likely to eat than the big slice of cheese pizza that's right underneath. Every time I look at the book, I don't even see the tomato. Right. I have to say,
I didn't see the tomato either until you said that.
It's brand new. It's for ages 12 and up. And I read a couple of pages of it, and it is written for younger people. But in the same way that, I don't know if you've seen that, Eat This, Not That for kids.
Right.
This is a little less, you know, one or the other. A little more like, in the end, you have to make the choices, and here's how to do it well.
Okay. We still got 10 seconds.
Happier at Home. Gretchen Rubin, who is the author of The Happiness Project, she suggests that to be happier at home, that we kiss more, which I think most of our husbands would appreciate. Jump more. I'm not exactly sure how that means. I feel like I'm jumping a lot. Abandon a project. Read Samuel Johnson. And then she has a whole bunch of other experiments you can try.
All right. Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And a link to the list, our book list, will be up on our website, capeandislands.org, on the program tab, pull down The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.